This is the story of the one. As a maintenance engineer, he hears things differently. To the untrained ear, everything on his shop floor might sound fine, but he can hear gears grinding or a belt slipping. So he steps in to fix the problem at hand before it gets out of hand. And he knows Granger's got the right product he needs to get the job done, which is music to his ears. Call, click Granger.com, or just stop by. Granger, for the ones who get it done.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Today's podcast is sponsored by FastBitcoins.com. FastBitcoins provides a simple way for people to buy Bitcoin directly from their bank account or with cash in physical stores. Their services are rapidly growing in availability across the UK, Estonia, as well as Canada, and they're launching in Australia soon too. FastBitcoins is committed to providing high-quality Bitcoin-only services. They want to make sure that the growing number of people interested in buying and benefiting from the possibilities of Bitcoin can do so easily, securely, and with as few distractions as possible. Learn more about Fast Bitcoin's range of services at fastbitcoins.com, including how you can earn Bitcoin for free through their referral scheme. That is fastbitcoins.com. Fastbitcoins.com, go check them out.
I am the man, sick with the slang, sick and I'm destined for fame. Do for the fam, not for the gram, stunt me, destined for pain. I do not front, I do not scam, put some respect on my name.
What's up, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls around the world? I would like to welcome you back to the Real Talk with Zuby podcast. Now, on today's episode, we've got on a friend of mine. He is a super interesting guy. He is an author. He is the host of the You're Welcome podcast, which I featured on last year. And this is Michael Malice. Welcome to the show.
Hey, Zuby.
How you doing?
I'm doing great.
Awesome, man. So we were just saying you're in the middle of New York right now. You're in Brooklyn. Hardest city hit by the virus that cannot be named, but how are you coping out there? It seems like things are coming back to normal.
Yeah, it was pretty rough for a bit. When you're, you know, I've lived here all my life, and when you're walking around outside, I was still going to the studio 4 days a week, and the streets are completely deserted. It does a number on you psychologically. I mean, what greater visual is there in a movie that economic times are tough than boarded up stores, right? Yeah. Now imagine where literally every store in your neighborhood is closed, and not only in your neighborhood, but everywhere you go. So it does have that kind of background subtext of despair. In addition, you know, New York is high population density. So to be riding the subway at like noon and to have no one else in the subway car is something without precedent. Even after 9/11, it wasn't like this at all.
Yeah.
So for quite a bit of time, it was a very tough adjustment. And to the point where, you know, like my crew, they were all thinking about like, we're over this, because, you know, at a certain point, if New York doesn't have what makes New York, New York, it becomes, we're paying exorbitant rates to be in a detention center. Mm-hmm. We could be paying non-exorbitant rates to be in a detention center somewhere
else.
That's a
good point, yeah.
But now I think very recently things have started opening up. You know, I was just last weekend in Williamsburg, which is like a, you know, used to be a big hipster neighborhood, and half the people weren't even wearing masks. So I think there is this kind of low key consensus that a lot of the concerns over this are overblown. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of people are, you know, we're New Yorkers. So the social isolation is not something that New York is a very lonely city in many ways,
sure,
but certainly not in the sense of being physically isolated. Mm-hmm. So I think having that at a certain point where we're like, yeah, we're not doing this, especially because our mayor, you know, de Blasio is regarded, I mean, like a lot of people maybe dislike Cuomo, but de Blasio's, the people who don't like him regard him with an enormous amount of contempt.
Okay.
So I think that to some extent fed into it as well.
Fair enough, man. So I've done a real brief intro of you right there, man. But for people who are not familiar with you, your background, and your work, tell us a little bit about who Michael Malice is.
Oh, Okay. I mean, I'm different from you. I think you're much more of a mass audience kind of guy, and I'm much more of a velvet rope kind of guy.
Okay.
So it's fun for me to be a bit of a cipher, but briefly, if I had to give my CV, I'm the author of Dear Reader, which is the one book about North Korea that tell you everything you need to know. And more recently, a book on the New Right, which is this kind of sociopolitical phenomenon that's erupted in the United States in around, let's say, 2014 and a bit earlier, and continues to this day. So those are my, and I'm a big, you know, troll on Twitter.
All the best people are.
Host two podcasts. Yeah, that's true. That's really true. I mean, it's an amazing, amazing thing to watch humor be weaponized against some truly wretched and depraved people. So, yeah.
Awesome, man. And to write this book on North Korea, I mean, you visited North Korea, right? You're one of the few people who's
been
there. I've been to a lot of places, man, but I can't say I've been to North Korea, nor can I say that it's ever been sort of particularly high on my vacation list.
Why wouldn't you want to go?
If I got the opportunity, I would. If someone invited me to North Korea, like later this year, I'd be like, yeah, screw it. Let's go. But I think for some fairly obvious, firstly, I don't think most people are aware that you can even go there.
Yeah. It's no longer the case. Now it's illegal for Americans at least to go. I thought it had been illegal to go, and it had been illegal for many years. In fact, you know, for a North Korean to have contact with an outsider, let alone an American, would have had severe consequences for them and their family, because it's such a ideologically isolated country by law. Mm-hmm. And I was on Facebook one day, this must have been 2010, and my buddy Ed, who I went to college with, and there's this dopey picture in Kim Il-sung Square waving in front of a tank, and I'm like, what is going on? And of course, the backstory is he met a guy at Burning Man, obviously, and there are a couple of companies that work with the North Korean government, Western companies, invite tourists. And basically the partnership works is these companies say, you know, we're going to vet these people, you know, because like, who are you letting in here? And they have a certain number of guides that they work with. And it was illegal, was not cheap. And you go there and it's, you know, there's no other country remotely like it on earth. Mm-hmm. So it's very, it's impossible to convey what it's like to be in North Korea. But I had the opportunity to go back. And then I saw two of my friends had gone since I had gone. And looking at their photos on Facebook, I was like, I can't do this again. Because the thing that people don't appreciate is that every single, you know, you walk around and you see Pyongyang, the capital city, you see some other cities depending on your itinerary. Mm-hmm. Everyone is still there. Like literally, you know, think about you go to London, you come to New York, you see people on the street. You don't know who this guy is. You don't know you see a tourist, they see from LA. Everyone I saw is still trapped in that prison. So that does a number on you, because you think about how much your life has changed or whoever listener's life has changed, you know, in 4 years, 6 years, their lives cannot change. Yeah. So it's very, very bleak when you think about this, and it makes you always keep in mind the plight of the North Korean population.
Yeah. I mean, so you got to sort of properly see a couple different cities?
Oh, yeah. Because after the collapse of the Soviet Union in 89 through 91, North Korea had for decades pitted China and the Soviet Union against each other. And they were, in a literal sense, a welfare state, getting effectively kickbacks from both countries. When that went away, North Korea, which produces nothing of value, had little to exchange with other countries. So in their quest for hard currency, meaning, you know, Chinese RMB or other forms of currency, US dollars, they're like, all right, I guess we can bring people here and have them look at it. So that is what they did. And Kim Jong-il, who's the father of the current leader of North Korea, Kim Jong-un, had said, quote, we don't want hordes of tourists coming in here, polluting our land and spreading AIDS. This was one of the lines that was in my Kickstarter for the book.
Okay.
So they were very averse to having foreigners, but at a certain point, it's like, all right, we need money desperately. And that was one. So there is a little bit of an ethical dilemma, because when you are going there, you are giving money directly to this government, which is the most evil government on earth, which is responsible for the genocide of millions of people during the 90s through famine. So that is something you have to think about. And the way I made my peace with it is I feel that my work and discussing this issue constantly and in you know, many forms of media, everywhere from Alex Jones to Al-Qaeda, Al-Qaeda, Al Jazeera.
I was like, man, this guy's
and Al-Qaeda. You know, I sat down with Bin Laden. We were watching these back in Pakistan. And I'm like, you know, North Korea is pretty bad. He's like, oh, God, tell me about it. Like, they don't even have planes to fly into buildings. They don't have buildings. I'm like, it's terrible, Osama. Having covered it in like every venue and really always sticking to the message of, doesn't matter what you think about Trump. It doesn't matter if you think Kim Jong-un's sister is cute. All that matters is the ongoing enslavement of this 20 plus population, million population that has been going on for 70 years, who have very little hope, who have to live with constantly looking over their shoulder because at any moment, their entire family, punishment is family style there, can happen. That is something that people have to always keep in mind when this issue comes up.
Mm, that's crazy. So were you able to, how long were you there for?
A week.
A week, okay. And were you able to sort of interact with locals and talk to everybody?
Yeah, so,
it was just like a free trip kind of thing.
Oh, it's not free trip.
Oh, sorry. I don't mean financially. I mean, as in you were able to.
No, you're not free in any sense. So every minute of your trip is planned for you, right? Which sounds more ominous than it is, because you can easily go to London and have an itinerary where it's like, okay, here we're going to the bookstore, here we're going to the London Museum, you know, here we're going to Tate Modern, whatever.
Yeah.
So that sounds more ominous than it is. But and you always do have your guides with you, but the guides aren't as, because these tourist companies get to pick their guides, the guides tend to be much more open-minded. Plus, when you live in Pyongyang, you know, to live in Pyongyang, the capital city, you can step foot there. They don't have internal migration. You have to have permission to move from city to city.
North Korea. Wow, okay.
And you have to have a family with a good family background, meaning loyalty to the government, to even to live in Pyongyang proper. They very much consider themselves kind of cosmopolitan urbanites, you know, kind of like London and New Yorkers, the snobbery. Mm-hmm. So, but at the same time, you know, I was born in Russia, mm-hmm. and I'm very aware of how people perceive Americans, right? Like obnoxious loudmouths. So I used this to my advantage. So everyone I saw in the street, I got in their face and I waved at them because I knew their reaction would be visceral and therefore sincere, right? Mm-hmm. If someone gets in your face, you're not going to have time to really think of what reaction. And the thing that's very disturbing about the North Korean population is they're really normal. So the grandmothers had their granddaughters and they're doting over them. And then the teenage kids, boys with their Adidas tracksuits with a sneer on their face, rolling their eyes at you, you know, and the girls giggling across the street. It was all like you'd expect, which makes it even worse because you would think, okay, if this government has turned these people into robots without any humanity, mm-hmm. then it wouldn't be as bad as realizing they're just as vapid and boring as anyone everywhere else. And, you know, and that's also good in the sense that once they are peacefully liberated, which will hopefully happen very soon, it won't be as tough of a transition to have them to have a more liberal, if not a democracy, at least certainly a country where they can, you know, watch whatever TV shows they like within limits and listen to whatever music they like and not have to be concerned about, you know, being deported to the countryside or worse because they have K-pop on their, you know, headphones and they have a right to have headphones.
Okay. What's the architecture and infrastructure?
So my friend, I left the Soviet Union when my family, we were 1.5. So of course I don't remember it at all. Yeah. My buddy moved when he was like 14, from the Soviet Union, and he was looking at my photos of North Korea and it blew his mind because he's like, this looks like Leningrad, but with Asian people walking around. Like it was a total screwing with his head because it was identical structures, but it wasn't Russians. So like he couldn't reconcile those two things.
Gotcha.
You know, North Korea started as a client state of Stalin's, you know, Soviet Union. Mm-hmm. And that's clearly trickled down in many ways, though now they're kind of trying to downplay that origin story in favor of elevating, you know, the founder of North Korea, the great leader Kim Il-sung.
Okay.
But it is the thing that to understand about North Korea, people think that when you go there, they're trying to show you how beautiful it is and how great, so you go back and report. Mm-hmm. They do not have that capability. Okay. None of us can appreciate what it's like to be in a capital city you know, the showcase city of any country and not have it have electricity at night. You know, you have these high-rise buildings and half the floors have no electricity. Mm-hmm. And the thing about North Korea is wherever you go, without exception, something will be wrong. So every wall will have a crack. Every carpet will have a stain. Everywhere I went, there was a fly, even on the plane. Mm-hmm. If the elevator bank has four buttons, one will be mismatched. If you go to a factory and there's a bathroom, the thing to flush the toilet will be rusted through. Yeah. So, and there's a smell that is very hard to describe. I have it in some of my books that I brought back. And if you go to their park, there's this, if you can look, you can look at this in Google. There's a park with this fountain with these white marble statues, and the fountain wasn't on. And the lights weren't on, and it was covered in mildew, just like in a shower. Yeah. So there's no the one place where everything looks really nice is the Friendship Exhibition Hall, which is they built this museum into the side of a mountain. And when you go in there, you have to take off your shoes. And on display, they have all the gifts that the leaders have received from other leaders from around the world, other presidents, prime ministers, and the like. And they have the basketball. But the thing is, because North Korea has very little context for many of the things that they have, it ends up being kind of comical because you have an old vehicle that Stalin gave the great leader Kim Il-sung, but you also have the basketball that Secretary of State Madeleine Albright gave to Kim Jong-il when she visited in the 90s, next to like an Amiga computer from the 80s with like a mouse and an instruction manual. And they're all side by side. And you're like, it's just some weird like kind of storage unit almost of like and a lot of these samovar sets, for those who don't know, those tea sets, the Russians, you got the teapot and you got the two cups, and there were like dozens of those. So I guess during this, you know, this the communist era, this was the big gift to give people, like a gift of a tea set. So there were a lot of those, and they were not nice looking.
Man, that's crazy. I think you're the only person I know who's actually been to North Korea. So it just fascinates me that in the modern era, in 2020, there is still a country, not even a small country, right? There's a country with 20 million people that we are not in contact with. They're not in contact with us. And I know, like, I'm so curious because I know quite a lot about the world in general, like probably more than the average person. But it's like there's just this one country there that I've never met anybody from. And I can't even, online, right? I'm not connected online with anybody from... I just don't know anything about it. And I think that is, it's almost crazy that that's even possible. You would not think that that was possible given the internet and how interconnected everybody and everything is now. So I think it's just fascinating.
Yeah. One of the things I discuss in my book, and it's the biography of Kim Jong-il. So Kim Jong-il is North Korea's Forrest Gump. Whenever anything interesting happens, he's supposedly there. So as he tells his life story, he's telling the story of how this country came to be. Mm-hmm. This didn't happen overnight. This is a very systematic centralization of power in the leadership position and in the state. Step by step, they closed down the borders. They exterminated people who have contact with the outside world. They tightened the thumb screws. They increased surveillance. They increased consequences. They stigmatized anything foreign. This took a long time. Mm-hmm. And thankfully, they haven't. It's very hard to waterproof a country, especially when ideas cost nothing to carry with you. Mm-hmm. And you know, there are some very big moments in North Korean history when the North Korean state started losing control of the script. One of the biggest ones, you can tell people that the great leader Kim Il-sung is the most wonderful human being who ever lived. You can't tell people that they had more food this year than they had last year, or that it's a good thing that their daughter is hungry. So these are things that it's very hard for them to work around. And truth and dishonesty are asymmetrical, right? So if I tell you 1,000 truths and one lie, yes. You know, like a murderer isn't murdering 24/7. He kills someone once, but that is what defines him for his entire life. So if I'm telling you propaganda all day and you find one thing that doesn't add up, very quickly I'm realizing, hold on, what's going on here? And these are not stupid people by any means. And a lot of the things they say aren't false, but simply logically incoherent. So for example, currently they're being taught that Kim Jong-un, the current leader, was able to drive a car at like 4 or 5 years of age. Now, let's suppose he's brilliant and knows how to do it. I don't think that's impossible, right? Let's just put that aside. The mechanics of a car aren't that complicated. How are his feet reaching the pedals, right? But like you laugh, but you have to live in a country where if your teacher tells you this, you know to smile and nod.
Yeah.
And if you don't smile and nod, your father might lose his job, or your mother might be, you know, called into the principal's office and you might not have food. Mm. So we don't appreciate how sinister it is to live in a state where anyone can do anything to you at any time, even from a childhood age, and you have to be aware of this. And in fact, I forget who it was, but they made the point that the more ridiculous a claim, the more useful it is to control the population.
Yes.
Because if you tell people things that are completely nonsensical, then you really know, all right, are you guys believing the nonsense and or acting as if you are? Either which is fine, mm-hmm. but this is a great way to quickly demonstrate levels of obedience and submission.
Wow. Yeah, that's crazy. I mean, you said you think it's going to be liberated soon. How do you see that happening?
These states go down hard and fast. There's this quote from Hemingway where it was, how did you go bankrupt? Two ways, gradually and then suddenly. Mm-hmm. So what brought down the Soviet Union was trashy culture. So you could tell people all day long about dialectical materialism and the dictatorship of the proletariat. And, you know, Lenin was the great genius of the ages. I'm some unintelligent average person at home, and I'm watching soap operas, and I see the maid on this soap opera has a fur coat and a car, and I'm literally wiping my butt with newspaper. Mm. At a certain point, I'm like, wait, why am I hungry when in this country, the maids are wealthier than the wealthiest person I know?
Yeah.
And that is happening now in North Korea. We all know young people around the world. There's some similarities. At a certain point, you want to listen to a song that isn't about the leader or that isn't about the military. I just want to dance, right? Mm-hmm. And having K-pop come in and having South Korean soap operas come in and having more refugees reporting back with things like cell phones and you have people and smugglers across the border. Mm-hmm. And when people report things back that are so disparate to what you've been taught and how you live, that cynicism toward the regime is very, very healthy. And a great thing is the one upside of the government not really being able to feed the population is you have these black markets, which the government basically has to look the other way. And that's how many people get their foods. But this is empowering these independent so-called business people, you would call them. They're often predominantly female. And the police, who are hungry themselves, now don't have power because they're just being bribed to look the other way. So this corruption is something that a country built on earnest worship of the state cannot abide with and sustain itself with long term. And at a certain point, someone is going to say, okay, this is why we're doing this. It's going to be like a domino effect, just like happened in 1989. There was this great, my favorite history book is called Revolution 1989 by Viktor Sebestyen. He's a Hungarian born historian. And he talks about how, you know, during the 70s, we were told very explicitly and constantly, Soviet Union is not going anywhere. We better sit down and shut up and have a detente and figure out how to work together. We have to learn how to learn all the cartoons. Even children are taught this. If you look at cartoons from that era, comic books, we have to learn how to work together. We have to learn how to live together. No one's going anywhere. This is forever. And then you had Gorbachev, Reagan, Thatcher, and Pope John Paul, to some extent, sat down and they're like, all right, we're not doing this. And when the Berlin Wall started coming down, and you had these borders starting to break down between Soviet bloc countries, and they're on the phone, the East German leader Hunker and Romania calling the leader there, Ceausescu, calling Gorbachev saying, dude, you have to send in the tanks. It's all falling apart. Like, people are crossing borders. They're not listening to the cops. We're losing our power. You got to send the tanks like you did to Hungary and like you did in the 50s in Prague, like you did in 68. And Gorbachev, to his infinite enormous credit, said, I'm not sending in the Russian tanks. You guys are on your own. And when everyone started looking around and we're like, they're not going to do anything, these countries' governments collapsed virtually overnight. My friend Simon, he's from Czech Republic. He was conceived, you know, under communism, born under after the Velvet Revolution.
Yeah.
And even when his mom was pregnant, she goes, I never even imagined the idea that you wouldn't be grow up under communism. That's how quickly these things happen. The big concern, of course, is China, because they do not want an American ally on their border, nor can you blame them. They don't want 20 million people who don't speak Chinese crossing the Tumen River. setting up camp in Manchuria, people who've never, you know, been online and have no real skills to deal with and who are desperately poor. Yeah. So these are two very real concerns about the collapse of the North Korean state and what's keeping it in power. But thankfully, I don't think it's going to last much longer, especially because Kim Jong-un has shown very many signs that he is on some level interested in liberalizing his nation. The problem he has is when these leaders go down, they personally are often and correctly shot.
Yes.
If you look at Libya, if you look at Iraq, if you look at Romania, if you look at Iran, the Shah in 79, the Shah had to get out of town very quickly.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of people in a leadership position with a country that has 100 to 200,000 people in concentration camps to this day that you can see on Google Earth, where it's going to be like, oh, we're not getting you a ticket to Tahiti. Like, you're either going to get shot or you're going to jail for the rest of your life. Or you're like unconscionable crimes against humanity. I mean, the blood of starving children is on your hands, and you did this gleefully and proudly. So that is a real a tricky situation for him personally, even if he wanted to liberalize to some extent, even just to get them to the China place of like levels of freedom.
From a psychological perspective, what do you think is it in, I mean, we can see this all throughout history, all over the world, and even in a lot of places now. What is it with certain human beings and the idea of power and control to that sort of extreme level? What do you think it is that's sort of innate in human beings that allows those sort of regimes to even be possible, right? It almost sounds like something out of a film or out of a movie or something when you're talking about even just the previous century, right? A lot of the stories, it sounds just like, what? How can that happen? And why would that happen?
I've thought about a lot because I've co-authored books with some celebrities. And when you do that, you have to learn how to see things through other people's eyes. And I can't even wrap my head around simply being a president and being responsible for war, even if you feel that war is justified. Because you know, if you're calling for war, that means a lot of moms and dads are going to get that telegram that their son died in the cause of service. And I don't know how you go to sleep at night knowing, I mean, oh, well, that's the cost you got to pay. That's a really tough thing that's got to weigh in on you, even under the best, let's suppose, World War II circumstances.
Sure.
So to get to the point where you are comfortable starving hundreds of thousands of your own countrymen to maintain your hold on power, when you are not allowing the UN to give them food, when you are concerned that there's a native dog breed that is going extinct, and you know this concern is because the dogs are being eaten because the people are trying at the point where they're eating bark and dandelion and saccharin just have something in their stomach. There's no bridge from my psychology to that point. It's totally alien to my thinking. And I think suspect to many other people's thinking.
Yeah, no, it's just crazy. I mean, because you see it in much more subtle forms, right? It's very rare for anything to get to that kind of extreme. But it does seem that, I mean, there is that well-known phrase, absolute power corrupts absolutely. But it does seem that even if you're in a Western liberalized democratic country, I mean, we've been seeing this over the past couple of weeks where you're just getting certain, whether they're mayors or governors or country leaders or whatever, who just like really, really like that power and control. I mean, I guess to even be in that position, you do have to be someone who is naturally does crave some form of power and control over others. Otherwise, you're not going to run for prime minister. You're not going to run for governor. You're not going to run for the president. But yeah, it's one of those things that I'm very interested in the way humans behave and how it sort of repeats and how you see these patterns throughout history. And like yourself, I can get it to some degree, but it's like, okay, there's a level where you're just like, wait, how do you even do that? And then how do people also go along with it? Because
there was one big clue, because I've always wondered, okay, do they believe their own crap, right? That's the big question. At what point do you start believing? And in Romania, the Ceausescu's were dictators for that country for a long time. And one of the greatest YouTube videos, you can watch this. I mean, they were like forcing people to breed by law because they wanted the population to increase. And because of this, you had all these orphans. It's just horrible. Even by communist standards, Romania was a very dark place, and Nicolae Ceausescu was inspired by the great leader Kim Il-sung. And you know, there all the propaganda in his book about how he's the genius of the ages and so on and so forth. And there's the moment I'm speaking about is he's giving a speech at some square because there had been like protests, and the people booed him like for the first time in decades. And you can see the second he looks over and he's like, whoa. Like it doesn't reconcile with his thinking. It's like if you it's like if you open your fridge and it's an aquarium, you're like, what I don't understand what this is. And he just looks and he would be dead within a week, I think. Wow. And what was amazing is they put him on this fake trial very quickly. He tried to get out of the country. They found him because he obviously his face is everywhere. They know what he looks like.
Yeah.
And during the trial where he refused to say anything, and it wasn't really a legal trial, it was a show trial to be fair, because the conclusion had been determined. The wife, who was even considered even more evil than him, was berating the people. And she said, how dare you? I raised you like a mother. So, you know, at that level, she really thinks that she's the one who's like giving them food and taking care of them and they're being ungrateful.
Yeah.
And that's when you're like, wow. I mean, we also forget the capacity of the human mind to tell itself what it needs to believe in order to maintain its fallacies and illusions. Mm. So we all have that. And to some extent, even you and I have to have that.
We have to
be convinced that we're more interesting than we are, because you got to go in front of a camera, right? And run your mouth for an hour. And 100% we're going to say something ignorant. 100% we're going to say something that doesn't make sense or contradict something else. And we have to be fine with that. Mm-hmm. But we're not responsible for thousands of lives. We're not responsible for killing parents and making kids into orphans, or vice versa, starving children.
Yeah.
And they are.
Yeah.
So I don't know what that is like. And frankly, you know, I have met one person who was, I would describe as a sociopath. There's a guy named Michael Alec, who was head of the Club Kids, which is a movement in New York in the club scene in the 90s, where they all dressed up in crazy costumes. There was a documentary about him, which was later made into a movie where he was played by Michael Alec. And I was in a store in Chelsea here in New York City. It's not the Chelsea in Britain.
Yeah.
And I saw a painting and I thought the signature said Malice. And I'm like, oh, that's weird. And it was M. Alec. And I'm like, wait, is that Michael Alec? And I bought the painting. My mom got it for my birthday. It's in my living room now. And then he later killed someone. He was known as a Club Kid Killer. And then he went to jail.
I think I've heard of him. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I visited him in jail. And I, you know, we all like, all of us, when we hear about like all these disorders, like that sounds like me. It's kind of like the horoscope. And then you meet someone who actually has it. You're like, oh, no. It is not a thin line between someone who's like annoying and someone who has borderline personality disorder.
Yeah.
It is a very, very thick line. It is not the kind of people you just find annoying in your office. Although sometimes it could be that. And talking to him, it was like very weird, knowing like very quickly, I'm like, this is not someone who's wired like anyone else I've ever met. Mm-hmm. So I'm curious if these types, if you met them, you're like, I'm looking into the face of the devil. I'll give you another example. It happened here in America with Lisa Bloom. Harvey Weinstein, at the very least, abused his power and treated women horribly. Right? At the very least. Let's give him every benefit of the doubt.
Yep.
Lisa Bloom, who is an attorney, her mom's a powerful feminist lawyer, Gloria Allred, in writing, she wrote to Harvey Weinstein when these allegations were coming out. She said, let's launch a campaign. This is in writing. Okay, this is what's amazing. Against Rose McGowan. First of all, I'm going to try to befriend her. While I'm trying to befriend her, we put a campaign in, kind of exploit the Google search results, and we plant stories to point out that she's a pathological liar and crazy. Then we have an interview you do where you talk about mistakes you made in the past. Maybe we have your mom with you and Trump's tape where he talks about grabbing women by the you-know-what, and you apologize, and then we try to bribe her. What does she want? Does she want to direct? And you're reading this, and you're like, you're the devil. Like, you're actually the devil, that there's this woman who you don't doubt necessarily has been the victim of, if not sexual assault, certainly horrible treatment. And you are offering, for the sake of money, to launch a campaign to portray her as crazy and a liar. I don't know how you can sleep at night doing that.
Yeah.
It would be one thing if you knew Harvey Weinstein was innocent and he's being railroaded.
Mm-hmm.
And you're like, this is not right. You have a family. You have a good reputation. That's not what this was.
Yeah.
And I don't know. At a certain point, money loses utility.
Yeah, yeah.
Like the difference between a millionaire and 2 million, it's your life's not going to matter statistically much at all. Maybe at a billionaire level. So I don't know. And maybe people get I think there's this perverse sense of pride in getting the system to be manipulated to your will, I guess, in some kind of weird Nietzschean way. But I can't relate to it at all.
Yeah, no, it's interesting. It's one of those things I wonder a lot. I mean, I do believe that, you know, well, firstly, I believe that the devil is real.
Oh, yes.
And then, yeah. And I just think evil is real. You know, I think that there are elements of it in every single human being. And we all know that we have all done and said nasty things at some point in our life, which could be considered evil. But there are levels, right? And there are some people, for whatever reason, where that evil is just, you know, they're evil doesn't need a reason, right? Like, the reason for evil is to do evil. So if someone is possessed by that and is driven by that, then at some point there's not really an explanation, right? There's some things you can explain and say, okay, this was the incentive, or there was this mental health problem, or there was that. But then it's like, at some level, there is just evil, where someone does go out and commits a mass shooting, and they legitimately just wanted to cause a massive harm. There's not a deep down reason that you can go and say, oh, it was this, it was that. There wasn't a motivation. The motivation was the evil itself. And I think that people don't think people ever like to reach that conclusion. People like to always think, okay, no, like, there's something that we could have done earlier, some interventions, you know, that nobody is evil, right? And it's like, I understand why you'd want to believe that, but I think I kind of know too much and have seen too much and read too much to buy into that, because it seems like this has existed for as long as humanity has.
Yeah, I read this book once called Cocaine, a Biography. It's a history of the drug. And the author is a journalist. He went to South America and he talked to two of these kind of gang lords. And these weren't just people growing cocaine and selling it peacefully. They were responsible for killing many people. Mm. And he's talking to them, and he's like, they're like these two fat Colombian guys. You know what I mean? It wasn't like, and they go, what'd you expect, horns? So when people are evil, they don't have a devil costume on. No. They're not glowing and levitating. Yeah. Like, Lisa Bloom looks like everybody else. The Ceausescu's, you're not going to pick them out of a lineup and be like, oh my God, that's the one. The guy, the mass murderer from Florida, I forget his name. They just made a documentary about him. Like, he looked, everyone was talking about how handsome he was. They look just like us is the thing. And that's what makes it even more sinister, because on a fundamental level, they are not human beings in the same way that you and I are.
Yeah, it's pretty crazy, man. So I want to talk a little bit. I haven't read your North Korea book yet, but I have read your book, The New Right. I read that last year.
Oh, okay.
I thought it was very, very interesting. And I love the fact that you really went into all of the dark corners of it, right? Not just the mainstream, I don't know. I think there are lots of books and people who talk about, I don't know, the rise of Trump or whatever. And it's like, okay, that was talked about, but you actually went and spoke to the really unsavory, the actual alt-right, right? People throw around terms like alt-right and white supremacy. They've become very diluted terms now, but you actually went and you spoke to a big range of people, from anarchists to actual white nationalists to people who just were on board, non-traditional conservatives or Republicans, etc. So firstly, not everyone listening would have read that book. So can you give us a little bit of a breakdown about it and why you wanted to write it?
Yeah, I think I'm the only person on earth, I'm certain, who was both at Charlottesville and has been to North Korea. So I've seen it all, baby. Yeah. And that's also funny to me when people on Twitter call me a coward, like, you know, because you don't want to argue with them. It's like, I've been to some pretty bad places.
Sure.
I mean, maybe not Da Nang, but it certainly wasn't fun getting on that plane to North Korea.
You've just given me an idea for a tweet, by the way.
with my blessings.
Yeah, which is that, look, if you hide behind a fake name and a fake avatar on social media, you have no right to call anybody a coward. Your entire online identity is rooted in cowardice.
Zuby, so there's no possibility of being brave on Twitter. You know, if you're in a free country, you could tweet at the president, you could tweet the cops, you could tweet at anybody, say, I hate you, blah, 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 you're garbage. You will have no consequences other than maybe a block. Oh my God, they blocked me. This is like a war wound. Shrapnel. I'm going down. So,
perspective.
Yeah, the reason I wrote the book, and it's a similar reason to why I wrote the North Korea book, is I had been swimming in these circles for quite some time. I am an anarchist myself. And then I saw so much of the content being produced about this was completely ill-informed and misinformed, and I think much of that by design. Mm. And I thought, someone is going to write this book and take control of this issue and this scene, and it might as well be me. Mm-hmm. And what I enjoyed about writing it, and you did, I talked to everyone, you know, in there, yeah, and with no shame in doing so, mm-hmm, is I think it's important for if someone has a perspective in a free country that we regard as somehow unsavory, many of those people are not a lost cause. Mm. Many of those people, and I discuss this in the book, are reacting to, you know, the reigning ideology, which is, you know, I find, you know, despicable and reprehensible. Mm-hmm. So they think, okay, I'm going to do the opposite. Well, the opposite is its own often kind of despicable and reprehensible. Yeah. And you know, one of my quotes is, you take one red pill and not the whole bottle. Mm-hmm. If someone doesn't grab some of these people by the collar and be like, no, you're hating the right people, yeah, but you're also hating the wrong people and going and thinking about this the wrong way. So I thought it was important to have a book like this also, where someone can explain and codify these kind of different ideologies, because they disagree about a lot. They, mm-hmm, only agree about their opposition to progressivism, sure, and have it written not from a mainstream perspective where, oh, these people are all stupid and crazy. Yeah, when you, yeah, say someone is crazy, that is you confessing you don't understand their thought process. Mm. And if someone is behaving in predictable, coherent ways, they might be wrong, they might be delusional, but they're, yes, not crazy. And, yeah, and that's one of the things I learned with the North Korea stuff. Before I started doing this, I moved the needle a little bit, and I'm proud of myself for it. They were often described as suicidal and crazy. And I said, if they're suicidal, how are they still standing when all these other countries fell apart? Mm. If they're crazy, how is it that they're still in power? It's, being crazy means not being in touch with reality. If you're not in touch with reality, it's really hard to stay on top, because you're not getting the data and processing it correctly that you need. So, yeah, that word is, when you hear people say that, that means often that they are having some kind of cognitive dissonance. They're feeling ideas that they can't port well to what they perceive the world to be, so they feel they need to dismiss preemptively. And many of their criticisms, if not wrong, mm-hmm, or you can even call them evil, are not incoherent, are not based on just, oh, this is, people suck. So, yeah. And it's also fun, you know, being Jewish and being an immigrant, talking to some of these types, because when you have any group, you're going to have the whole range of mindsets. Mm-hmm. So you're going to have people who will treat you as an individual. I'm sure there's many racists who you've talked to who, well, this happened to me, because in Russia, there's a lot of anti-Semitism. And my dad would tell me, there was a college professor who patted him on the back and said, Ted, you're one of the good ones, you know, about, yeah, being Jewish. And, yeah, and the guy thought he was, you know, being normal, and you're like, it'll be a lot better if you just hated me than if you're being like, you're good, but like everyone you're related to is garbage, you know, yeah, what I mean, just, yeah, because of who they are. Yeah. So it was an interesting ride, and I cover all the big personalities, and it's kind of structured how, as the book goes along, there's this big claim, which I don't think is absurd, that this whole scene is like a slippery slope. Mm-hmm. And the book really is the slippery slope, because as the book proceeds, the people get more and more kind of removed from the mainstream thought, yeah, and everyone's going to have to figure out where they draw the line in terms of, okay, I can't go past this. This is where I am not comfortable, and I think this is just really wrong.
Yeah, yeah.
If,
yeah,
at,
no,
all.
Yeah, no, it's interesting. I mean, the thing I think with any extreme ideology, again, this is one of those things that is true, but you're not supposed to say, I think I say a lot of those things, is that most, whether someone goes like super far left or super far right, any direction, they are right about some things.
Yes, yeah.
Right? There's a current, even if you took the most far left communist, like authoritarian communist person, right? There are certain things that they believe which are actually right. The problem is that they take them to an extreme, and they also believe it comes with a whole bunch of baggage of stuff that is very wrong and often very despicable. Same like with the far right. So they may have certain concerns or things that they think are not being addressed or aren't being voiced or whatever, which actually I'm like, yeah, fair enough. I actually agree with that. But then the other stuff, then it's like, oh, no, no, like, no, not that part, not that part. And I think a lot of the issue, especially in terms of bringing people back from the fringes and sort of moderating people, is not an unwillingness to kind of give the devil its due at all, right? To, yeah, not want to just say, look, that person believes, this person has 10 beliefs, and these two are completely insane. So that means the other 8 are also wrong and insane. But those other eight could be very astute observations and valid concerns. So you need to address those ones. Otherwise, I think more people can potentially get drawn into those more extreme ideologies or political parties or whatever the case may be, because the people in the middle, right, the sort of normal conservatives or normal liberals or normal libertarians or whatever, are just totally unwilling to even discuss certain things. I think that's one of the big problems that I see with what people call political correctness, right? It's, here's a great example. In the UK, you must have heard of this grooming gang situation.
Oh my gosh, Rotterdam,
Going on for a long time, okay? Not wanting to be addressed by the police or the authorities, etc. They were afraid of creating racial tensions. They didn't want to be called racist. They didn't want to be called Islamophobic. So thousands and thousands of girls are getting groomed and sexually assaulted and molested and raped because they don't want to address this issue. Who were the people who were banging on about this issue for a long time? It was people who in the UK were considered far right. It was the British National Party. It was guys like Tommy Robinson. If I can say his name, I've probably just been demonetized now. It was,
Let me interrupt you for people who don't realize the BNP aren't like the Republicans.
No.
They are the people to the right where even Farage is like, I'm not talking to you guys.
Yes,
so let's
yes.
be clear. This is, when you say far right, you're not using that term loosely.
Yes, no, I use it properly. Yeah, using the term properly. But they were talking about that, right? They were talking about that. But because they were talking about it, no one else, for a long period of time, it was like, oh, we can't even touch this issue. And it's like, yeah, well, lots of their other stuff was very unsavory and despicable, but that was a valid concern, right?
Yeah.
There are valid questions and concerns that people may have about immigration that are not rooted in hatred of people from other countries or hatred of people's skin color or whatever. But I think we all on a fundamental level understand that you don't want to just tomorrow say, you know what, anyone from anywhere in the world can come into the UK. As long as you can make it to the shore, you're welcome. Right. Some people are super naive and think that's some kind of good idea. But I think most people, right, even a progressive, even a liberal would be like, no, OK, there's got to be some limitation. There have to be some rules. You can't just have the population double tomorrow. And, you know, how are we going to feed everybody? Where are they going to live? What's going to go on? What about crime?
We'll figure it out.
So coming back to what I was saying, I mean, that's what, it's one of those weird ones because it's kind of uncomfortable for people because once people go past a certain line, you don't want to associate with them. Most people won't even want to talk to them or even listen at all. And at least, even if you think they're wrong, even just listen to what they're sort of saying. And so, like I said, what I really liked about your book, The New Right, was that you crossed that boundary and didn't just sort of write people off and keep it perfectly within this safe zone.
Yeah. So like, let's talk about that BNP example you used, because that's a good one. Mm. Because people will say, and I think truthfully and accurately, that their concerns about these girls are for the wrong reasons. Like, it's not that they really care about these girls per se, that they're more concerned about, you know, blah, 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 you know, mm-hmm. keeping Britain white and all this mm-hmm. other stuff. And there's an inverse of that. So if I'm talking about this issue for the wrong reasons, people don't need to address it. I mean, that's a demented mentality. People probably wouldn't express it explicitly, but that is what it looks like happened. But there's the inverse of that, which is if I'm talking about this issue for the right reasons, then I'm not really responsible for the consequences of my policies or my views, because mm-hmm. at least I have the right goal at heart. And I'm like, I don't agree with that at all.
Yeah.
First of all, I don't necessarily know that your vision is good. I don't think good, if it doesn't correlate to reality, is good. I think it's just delusion. And you do have to have accountability for what this would look like, because history is full. You know, I hate the cliche, the road to hell is full of good intentions. I don't think their intentions are often good.
Yeah.
I think their intentions are also, like you're saying, that's in a democracy, it lets that person feel powerful because now I'm the one helping people. I'm kind of that messiah figure. Mm-hmm. So a lot of that has a malevolent subtext as well, like using other people's as a means to your own salvation and not being genuinely concerned with their health or well-being so much as that I got to be one of the good people who helps, not like those bad people who don't care. Mm-hmm. You see this a lot with, you know, what they call slacktivism on Facebook and Twitter, where if I just change my profile picture to the right thing, all of a sudden I care about the people with France. Mm-hmm. And one of the things I talk about in my work, and I've done a lot of research about the Harlem Renaissance and you know, fringe figures in the past, It's like, where were you when these figures needed some, where were you for gay rights before Stonewall?
Yes.
Like, now you're for gay rights when Times Square is all rainbows.
It's easy and now.
It's easy now. Yeah. Where were you when these people were getting fired and were regarded as basically like sexual predators and complete deviants? Mm-hmm. You were in your nice little bougie house reading the New York Times, which proudly reported the people who were fired at these raids. Mm-hmm. And it's this. It's all these people on Twitter think that they would have fought for the North during the Civil War. Yeah. And it's like, you're saying this in 2020. I do not believe you that you would have been signing up in 1861 mm-hmm. to fight for this, when even the Northerners didn't think they were fighting for slavery so much mm-hmm. preserving the Union. So there's so much a question about perception, how people want to view themselves in terms of time travel, that it's kind of ridiculous to observe.
Yeah, definitely. I always say the majority of people would have acted as the majority of people. Right.
Yeah, so look at Germany. Like, do you think like Hitler comes? He didn't have a magic wand.
No.
Like, everyone follows the leader. They follow the country, and then now Germany's normal. I mean, that exactly. The majority. That's a great way of putting it, Zubia. That's exactly right.
Mm. Yeah. No. It's it's really interesting. I think there are so many things that exist in the world, sort of individually and collectively, which are super interesting, but they're just uncomfortable. And so people just don't want to go there, don't want to discuss that. And, you know, yeah, sure. Do I think some things should be taboo? Yeah, actually, yeah. And certainly in a polite conversation, I don't think everything should be brought up all the time. But I think that if something is a sort of legitimate concern and something that matters, the fact that it is simply uncomfortable, or that we don't like the stats, or we don't like the facts, or we don't like whatever the case may be, that's a really lame and long-term dangerous reason not to address it. And I'll give you a good example
where that's having specific, concrete, horrific consequences. And this is nothing to do with partisanship or ideology. Mm-hmm. Before, at Thanksgiving, I talked about this when I was on Rogan, a friend of mine came out to me. He had been the victim of childhood sexual abuse. Mm-hmm. And he was scared to tell me. And I realized, wait a minute, this is really, really bad. Because if I told you that my mom was a drunk or my dad was a deadbeat, you'd feel bad for me. You wouldn't think anything. It'd be like, you know, okay, conversation would skip a beat. Mm-hmm. When someone, we don't want like thinking about children and sexuality with good reason. That's not how any decent person thinks. Their mind never goes there with good mm-hmm. reason. But that's how these predators get away with it. Because my friend was scared to tell me because he didn't know if I was going to freak out. He didn't know if I was going to treat him like a broken bird. And after I talked about it in Rogan, I had three other friends come out to me privately that they had been the victim. So if I know at least four people, that means this happens a lot more. And it can't be the way that if you have a friend who has this, that they should feel uncomfortable telling you and that you're going to bug out. Because that trauma and that abuse they suffered as children, they grow up and they have to sit there and keep that secret. And that person who did this to them, this horrible person, is walking around, having gotten away with it. And that's the technique they use. So that is a very concrete example of where if people don't want to talk about something and you can't blame them. It has severe consequences for children.
Yes, most definitely. Most definitely. And I mean, it's weird. I mean, that's the same way I feel. Of course, you mentioned Harvey Weinstein earlier, but there is a lot of, I don't even know how far it all goes. I mean, there is especially in the world of entertainment, Hollywood, music industry, et cetera, right? I'm in the music world and there is a lot of dodgy stuff. There's just a rabbit hole. I myself don't even know how deep it goes, but we've seen things, right? We saw Jeffrey Epstein, right? Like, what happened there? People have stopped talking about that now, right? The dude got whacked in public.
What about Prince Philip or Prince Albert, whichever one it is, Prince Charles's brother, I forget them confused. Like, he's walking around.
Yeah.
It's like, Prince Andrew, you did this. You were known to have done this. That interview was a train wreck. Yeah. Like, you were just lying. And it's like, there's no real consequence to you. If someone had said that there is an international sex trafficking ring and ABC News is going to report on it, and then the royal palace called them and killed the story, you would have thought, okay, Alex Jones, put your tinfoil hat on. But that's what happened. But this is the thing, is we're trained.
Yeah.
We're trained since children in school to think that people in leadership positions are there by dint of their virtue. And that even if they maybe sometimes they're corrupt, like, oh, I'm going to get my brother a job and he's going to get a kickback, mm-hmm. that they're not going to engage in like this kind of unimaginable depravity.
Yeah.
And we're finding out this happens a lot.
Yes.
And there will be people who tell you tooth and nail, this would have happened, let's say, 10 years ago. How could you? Bill Cosby would never do something. How could you say something like that? I watched the Cosby Show. Bill Cosby, how you're a monster to think he's capable of doing this. And when you have, what, 40 women? Let's assume half of them are lying. Let's pretend, right? Yeah. Half of them are consensual. 20 women then. And you're like, oh, if this isn't like he got him drunk and fooled around. This is really not a thin line, not a gray area, sustained campaigns, and this happens a lot, and everyone knows about it. That's the part that is the darkest part, that it's not like it was a, if I knew about Harvey Weinstein before this happened and I knew about it, well, everyone knew. And that means that there's systems in place, just like Prince, whatever. I can't remember his name. I'm Joe Biden. Prince Andrew. When I think of Prince Andrew, I think of a piercing. There are systems in place to make sure these people never not only have consequences, but never even have to be acknowledged of these rumors. And thankfully that is changing very quickly because of social media.
Yeah. Yeah. It's wild. And then, you know, all these celebrities, I mean, how many celebrities knew about some of this stuff, right? How many people knew about Jeffrey Epstein? How many people knew about Harvey Weinstein? Tons of them, right? And then these are the people who are there. This is why virtue signaling, especially amongst celebrities, jars me so much.
Oh yeah.
Because so many of them, so many of people's idols who they think are these wonderful, lovely people, I'm like, look, some of these people were, they knew some of this stuff, right? They know this. So I don't care how much they hashtag on Twitter or what, you know, it's like, there's something really dark there, like really sinister. If you are aware that this thing is going on, but because of your, to protect yourself and your fame and your money, et cetera, even though you've already got enough of it, you are willing to just let it slide. And then maybe when it comes out there, or maybe then you'll sort of say, oh, like, you know, I thought something was going on, but, and I'm just like, man, it's kind of disheartening in a way.
People, we had a little exchange yesterday on Twitter, right? People who follow our tweets, and that is our thoughts and putting ourselves out there much more than a celebrity who's an actor, because they have, you know, publicists, they have people looking over their stuff, they have a team, feel that they know us. And you and I have both experienced with people. Some people will argue with me that I'm not really this way because I'm really like this. And I'm like, you're telling me you know me better than me. We're going to have to connect. Yeah. But then you have to realize if that happens with us, whose personality dictates our work, if it's someone who's an actor who you've never met, you do not know that person.
No.
You do not know them at all. Their job is to project a certain kind of image. They could be in real life really, really cool. Mm-hmm. They could be jerks, or they could be really, really dark.
Yeah.
And you would have absolutely no way of knowing it. And the most important thing is when the people are really dark and depraved, those are the ones who are usually the best at passing because they've had to do that their whole lives. And they're the ones who get off on passing because they get a sick kick of having people think that they're just like you and me when they are on a fundamental level dead inside and they know it. I mean, this is how sociopaths operate.
Yeah.
It's very well established. And sociopaths are drawn to power and they're drawn to hurting other people. But then we're also taught, oh, that's crazy talk. Not everyone's a sociopath. This doesn't really happen. These are outliers. It's like being the president is an outlier. There's only been 45 of them.
Yeah.
So it's not going to be a statistical sample of the average American or the average person on earth.
Yeah, most definitely, man. Michael, what have you got coming up next, man?
I'm currently working on a book about Albert Camus, who is a philosopher who has profoundly affected my thinking. So I've started writing that and hope to get it out as soon as possible.
Okay, awesome. And for people listening, where can they follow you online and check out your work?
I'm at twitter.com/Zuby Music in blackface.
Well, I'm not,
like a modern day Trudeau.
Hey, I heard about Joe Biden. I'm not black anymore.
No. You ain't black. You can't use the correct diction. It's not you aren't. You ain't. Because, you know, we can't talk like white people. We have to talk.
I ain't black. I ain't black.
Yeah.
Uncle Joe has.
Uncle Joe's cabin.
Uncle Joe is kindly let me and a billion plus other
people. Yeah.
Just, okay,
ain't
man.
Black.
Yeah. Wow. What a statement. Awesome, Michael. But thanks so much, man. What's your real handle?
Michael Malice.
Michael Malice. Yeah. I realized you still didn't give it. Awesome, man. Thank you so much for coming on the show, bro. Really good to
talk
to you.
Always a pleasure.
I am the man, sick with the slang, sick and I'm destined for fame. Do for the fam, not for the gram. Stunt me, you're destined for pain. I do not front, I do not scam. Put some respect on my name. Sick like Cobain, click and I bang. Y'all gon' remember the name. Y'all gon' remember the name.
This is the story of the one. As a maintenance engineer, he hears things differently. To the untrained ear, everything on his shop floor might sound fine, but he can hear gears grinding or a belt slipping. So he steps in to fix the problem at hand before it gets out of hand. And he knows Granger's got the right product he needs to get the job done, which is music to his ears. Call, click Granger.com, or just stop by. Granger, for the ones who get it done.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.